In the owner's Ponderay decision, he and jockey Brian Hernandez Jr. basked in a wash of congratulations for a Derby victory that put them in exclusive company. Saturday's win helped both claim rare weekend sweeps of the Derby and Kentucky's Oaks for the Phillies. McPeak is just the third trainer to do that, and first since Ben Jones, who did it twice in 1952, while Hernandez is the eighth rider to achieve the feat, and first since fellow Louisiana native and Hall of Famer Calvin Burrell in 2009. Meanwhile, Mystic Dan just stood calm and unfazed as a cluster of onlookers took photos and selfies as workers bathed him outside the barn. He was then draped with a winner's blanket, signifying his Derby win, before being led back to his stall with a WWE-style title belt laying on an outer wall. Oaks winning filly Torpedo Anna also made a brief appearance and soaked in the attention. Hernandez is preparing for his own life-changing spotlight and title after claiming the sport's marquee race. He dined with his family after the Derby but didn't sleep much, a routine that figures to go on for the next few days. Amid a flood of interview requests, at some point he hopes to get his mind around all that has happened, but he already has a response ready. When somebody asks what my profession is, I'm able to tell them I'm a professional jockey. And then the first question they normally ask is, have you ever won the Kentucky Derby? I can say that now. And before we sign off, I just want to, I forgot to give you the baseball scores from yesterday. Cleveland 4, the Angels 1, Washington 11, Toronto 8, Texas 3, Kansas City 2 in 10 innings, Chicago White Sox 5, St. Louis Cardinals 1, Baltimore 11, Cincinnati 1, and Miami at Oakland. I do have the score. I know Miami won that game. It was 8-3, I believe. The National League, Pittsburgh 5, Colorado 3, Washington 11, Toronto 8, Chicago Cubs 5, Milwaukee nothing, Chicago 5, St. Louis 1, and the other games did not make the current. And what's on the air today? Baseball, 6 p.m., Detroit at Cleveland, that's on FS1, 7:30 p.m., New York Mets at St. Louis, that's on SNY, Radio 880, WCBS out of New York. Basketball, NBA Eastern Conference Playoffs, second round, Indiana at New York, Game 1, TNT, 10 p.m. Western Conference Playoffs, second round, Minnesota at Denver, Game 2, TNT, and one hockey game at 8 p.m. on the NHL schedule, Eastern Conference Playoffs, second round, Boston at Florida, Game 1 on ESPN. That's the sports for today. Hope you have a great day, everybody, and please stay safe.
You're listening to Chris, celebrating 40 years as Connecticut's talking newsstand for the blind and print challenged.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup on Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, it's Monday, May 6, 2024. I'm Arlene Ford, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Current and New York Times with me today is Lou Mirando. Let's begin by taking a look at the photos on the front page of the Hartford Current, and there are three of them. The first one we're looking at, we see an individual. It's a guy. He's dressed. He has a baseball cap on, a T-shirt, and of course, it looks like jeans. And in this photo, he is at one of the electric charging stations, and he is charging his vehicle. And the caption under the photo reads, Jonathan Roach of Springfield, Massachusetts, charges his rental car during his lunch break at the Electrify America charging station in November in Manchester. And we're going to be doing a story on this later on in the broadcast about the electric vehicle legislation. And our next photo, we're looking at a young lady. She's got long, dark brown hair. She's dressed in black, and she's holding an enlarged photo of her twin brother. And I'll read the caption. It says, Clarice El Arabi holds a photo of her twin brother, Michael Randall Sr., at the New Haven Green on Thursday. She lost her brother 5 years ago in a fire. And we're going to be doing a story on that as well later on in the broadcast. And then the last photo, we see someone's hands holding a cell phone, and they're doing banking on their phone. And the caption here reads, a recent survey showed 45% of Americans favored mobile apps for managing their banking, and just 14% sought out a branch. And that's it for the photos on the front page of The Current. Let's now go to Lou for pictures of the front page of the New York Times.
Hello. Today we'll be doing Monday, May 6, 2024, New York Times front pages. And the first big picture is that of four workmen in white jumpsuits. And this is in Brazil. And you can see that they're walking through a field of tilled mounds of soil. And basically the picture is that of how Brazil is slowly changing from cattle ranches to other methods of farming to avoid planet warming carbon emissions. As a result, for the cattle ranches, they're taking down rainforests. So we're going to have a story on that. It's hard to explain the photo, but the story will explain it better. Then there's another small picture of a headstone, a bronze headstone in the ground for a Marcus Johnson, and there's a bouquet of flowers just above it. And he was a prisoner, and he died from a mental collapse in a prison. And we're going to have a story about mental illness in prisons. And then the third picture is that of an artist by the name of Frank Stella. He was a minimalist painter and reinvention, and he used to create very large murals. And he passed away, and we're going to have a short story on that also. And that's it for the front page of the New York Times. We'll start with the lead story from Arlene now.
12 Ukrainians hurt in Russian drone attack on Orthodox Easter. This is out of Kiev. As Ukrainian marked its third Easter at war, Russia launched a barrage of drones Sunday concentrated in Ukraine's east, wounding more than a dozen people, and said its troops took control of a village they had been targeting. Ukraine therefore said Russia had launched 24 Shahed drones overnight, of which 23 were shot down. Six people, including a child, were wounded in a drone strike in the eastern Kharkiv region, regional governor Oleh Sinubov said. 14 more were wounded in an airstrike Sunday afternoon on the regional capital, also called Kharkiv. The regional prosecutor's office had said. Sinubov said the city was attacked by an aerial bomb. Fires broke out when debris from drones that were shot down fell on buildings in the neighboring Dnipropetrovsk region. No casualties were reported. The Russian Ministry of Defense announced Sunday that its troops had taken control of Oktyabrsky, which had been in the crosshairs of Russian forces in the Donetsk region of eastern Ukraine. Drone footage obtained by the Associated Press showed the village battered by fighting. Not a single person is seen in the footage obtained late Friday, and no building in Oktyabrsky appears to have been left untouched by the fighting. Officials in Kiev urge residents to follow Orthodox Easter services online, citing safety concerns. Sahir Popko, head of the Kiev City Administration, warned that even on such bright days of celebration, we can expect evil deeds from the aggressor. In his Easter address, President Volodymyr Zelensky called on Ukrainians to be united in one common prayer. A majority of Ukrainians identify as Orthodox Christians, although the church is divided. Many belong to the Independent Orthodox Church of Ukraine. The rival Ukrainian Orthodox Church was loyal to the Patriarch in Moscow until splitting from Russia after the 2022 invasion, and is viewed with suspicion by many Ukrainians. Thieves killed... Now, this is about another story, missing tourist in Mexico. Thieves killed two Australians and an American on a surfing trip to Mexico in order to steal their truck, particularly because they wanted the tires, authorities said Sunday. Baja California state prosecutors released grisly details of the slayings, but have not yet officially confirmed the identification of the bodies. They said family members of the victims are viewing the bodies to see if they can be identified by sight. The corpses were decomposing after the thieves dumped them into a remote 50-foot deep well about 4 miles from where the foreigners were killed. If relatives can't identify the bodies, further tests will be conducted. The well also contained a fourth cadaver that had been there much longer. The probability that it's them is very high, Chief State Prosecutor Maria Elena Andre Ramirez said. The three men were on a camping and surfing trip along a stretch of coast south of the city of Ensenada, posting idyllic photos on social media of waves and isolated beaches. They went missing last weekend.
Negotiations between Israel and Hamas hit an impasse, by Adam Gregson. The latest round of negotiations between Israel and Hamas hit an impasse on Sunday as mediators struggled to bridge remaining gaps and a Hamas delegation departed the talks in Cairo, according to two senior Hamas officials and two other officials familiar with the talks. An Israeli official also confirmed the negotiations had stalled and described them as being in crisis. For months, the negotiations aimed at achieving a ceasefire and a release of hostages have made little progress, but signs the two sides were coming closer to an agreement appeared over the last weekend. Israel backed off some of its long-standing demands, and a top Hamas official said the group was studying the latest Israeli offer with a positive spirit. But the setback over the weekend meant Palestinians living in miserable conditions in Gaza would not experience an immediate reprieve, and the families of hostages held by militants would have to wait longer for the freedom of their loved ones. The main obstacle of the talks was the duration of the ceasefire, with Hamas demanding it be permanent and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel expressing openness to only a temporary halt in the fighting. Hamas blamed the lack of progress on Mr. Netanyahu, who vowed again that the Israeli army will invade Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza Strip, with or without agreement. We are very close, but Netanyahu's narrow-mindedness aborted an agreement, Musa al-Abzor, a senior Hamas official, said in the phone interview. The Israeli official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said the Israeli and Hamas were closer to a deal a couple of days ago, but that Mr. Netanyahu's statements about Rafah had compelled Hamas to harden its demands in an attempt to ensure that Israel forces won't enter the city. Hamas, Mr. Abu Mazarik said, thought that Mr. Netanyahu wanted an agreement that would permit Israel to invade Rafah after its hostages are released. The Biden administration has been pressing Israel to refrain for undertaking a major operation in Rafah, where about 1 million Palestinians have been sheltering since the start of the war. On Monday, Hamas's political leadership will convene in Doha to discuss what unfolded in Cairo over the past 2 days. The group intended to continue participating in negotiations with positivity, said one of the senior Hamas officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity.
Protesters agreed to clear out of USC encampment. Graduations held elsewhere, some flags for Gaza seen. Students protesting the war in Gaza left a pro-Palestinian encampment at the University of Southern California early Sunday after they were surrounded by police and told they could face arrest if they didn't go, while Northeastern University's commencement began peacefully at Boston's Fenway Park. Developments in both places were being watched closely following scores of recent arrests. The USC move days before commencement is set to begin came after the university said campus safety officers assisted by the Los Angeles Police Department were clearing the area. If you are in the center of campus, please leave. People who don't leave could be arrested, USC said on the social platform X around 4:15 a.m. Livestream video from student journalists showed that the encampment had emptied out as police formed a line to move remaining protesters away and stop people from reentering. The encampment had restarted after the LAPD arrested 93 people on April 24th. The atmosphere on campus had largely remained calm since then, while attention turned to arrests at the University of California, Los Angeles. In Boston, commencement for Northeastern saw some students waving Palestinian flags, but those were dotted among flags from India, the U.S., and other nations. Graduate students went first, with undergraduate commencement in the afternoon. Last month, police arrested about 100 protesters at Northeastern when they broke up an encampment. At the University of Virginia, 25 people were arrested Saturday for trespassing after police clashed with pro-Palestinian protesters who refused to remove tents from campus, and demonstrators at the University of Michigan chanted anti-war messages and waved flags during commencement ceremonies. USC, a private university, has been the subject of student protest over the war, as well as the administration's decision to cancel a commencement speech by the valedictorian, a Muslim student who had expressed support for Palestinians. The university made that decision last month, citing safety concerns after receiving threats. Some Jewish groups had criticized the student's selection as speaker. Administrators later canceled the entire main stage commencement planned for May 10th, when 65,000 people were expected to gather. Other activities, including graduation ceremonies for individual schools and colleges, are still scheduled from Thursday through Sunday. Access to campus has largely been restricted since late April for people not affiliated with the university. It was the latest clash at U.S. colleges and universities that have seen dozens of protests over the Israel-Hamas war. Many of the encampments have been dismantled by police. Tent encampments are protesters urging universities to stop doing business with Israel or companies they say support the war in Gaza have spread in a student movement unlike any other this century. Some schools reached agreements with protesters to end the demonstrations and reduce the possibility of disrupting final exams and commencements.
In Biden's bid for re-election, he spotlights the insulin price gap by Zolan Cano-Young. Kay Peterson, a 66-year-old retired librarian, is a direct beneficiary of one of President Biden's proudest domestic policy achievements, lowering the cost of insulin for seniors. A longtime diabetic, Ms. Peterson, for much of her life, spent around $300 a month on insulin to keep her blood sugar at a safe level. Now she pays $35 and uses the savings to help fund her room in the assisted living facility in Kentucky. Mr. Biden's policy, she said on a recent afternoon, was a godsend because it enshrines into law that Americans on Medicare, the federal health insurance program that covers people over 65 and some younger ones with certain disabilities, will not spend more than $35 per month on insulin. As Mr. Biden makes his case for re-election, he regularly cites the cap on out-of-pocket costs for insulin on TikTok, in campaign advertisements, and in speeches around the country. He sees the law as a crucial part of his record heading into the 2024 election, with bipartisan support and particular resolution for Americans with diabetes, one of the most common chronic diseases in America. It also mirrors something of a generation gap in Mr. Biden's base of support. Recent polling shows that voters older than 65, who usually vote Republican, are emerging as reliable supporters of Mr. Biden. Younger voters, however, are showing signs of dissatisfaction, and some of these voters say that they are still hoping for the reassurance of having the $35 limit written into law for them. Biden is doing better with older voters than he anticipated, and I think his Medicare policies are an important part of that, said Jeff Garland, a pollster for Biden's campaign. But he acknowledges that among younger voters, there's some frustration with them that change is not happening quickly enough. But Biden campaign officials look to the state of Georgia as an example of how powerful the issue can be. During the 2022 Georgia runoff won by Senator Raphael Warnock, he focused his ads, debates, and speeches on capping the cost of insulin. Mr. Warnock said that the issue can be a way of galvanizing voters of color. Black people are disproportionately likely to ration insulin as well as to energize a broader coalition. It's an equity issue, a justice issue, and a people issue, Mr. Warnock said. Before that, when he struggled to pay for insurance, he said he needed to choose between a roof over my kid's head or pay for my medicine. He, too, rationed his insulin on one occasion and landed in the intensive care unit. I remember hearing my own flatline, Mr. Martin said. A lot of people says when you die, your life flashes before you. What I had seen was my kids growing up without me. Mr. Martin is not sure Mr. Biden's policy will be enough to win his vote, but he says Mr. Biden has won his respect. You don't know how many lives you're saving, Mr. Martin said. I would shake his hand and say thanks.
Trump trial has dry bases, juicy bits. Business angle not part of the engaging testimony as it opens. This is out of New York. Former President Donald Trump is on trial facing 34 felony counts of what could be the dullest sounding crime in New York's penal code, falsifying business records. Yet across 9 witnesses and 2 weeks of testimony, jurors have been treated to hours of mesmerizing courtroom theater. There was talk of a sex scandal with an adult film star, a surreptitious recording of a future president, and the tearful testimony of a former confidant in the glare of the witness stand. There was even a celebrity roll call. Charlie Sheen, Lindsay Lohan, and reality television star Tila Tequila, were all name-checked, drawing chuckles in the lower Manhattan courtroom. The phrase falsifying business records, however, was not uttered to the jury during testimony. That striking omission underscores the prosecution's strategy for the opening phase of testimony. Spotlight the sleaze and soft-pedal the records. Although the defense has taken a swipe at the approach, legal experts say it represents the prosecution's best shot at winning the case, the first criminal trial of an American president. In their opening statement, prosecutors from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office preview the false records to the jurors, casting them as straightforward paper lies that covered up a hush money payment to the adult film star. But tying Trump to those records is hardly simple. Only one witness directly links Trump to falsifying the records, and that person, as the defense noted, is a convicted liar. So the prosecution started with the strongest card in its hand, eliciting testimony about the sordid stories that Trump is accused of covering up. Prosecutors say he concealed them to shield his 2016 campaign from scandal, orchestrating an illegal conspiracy to undermine the integrity of a presidential election. Trump is not charged with conspiracy, but New York law requires prosecutors to show that Trump falsified the records to conceal another crime. The purported election conspiracy and all its alleged detail would essentially establish his motive. By foregrounding the conspiracy, prosecutors are captivating the jury while laying a foundation for evidence about the business records to emerge. In Manhattan, Trump is one of dozens of defendants to face the falsifying business records charge over the past decade. Prosecutors can charge it as a felony rather than a misdemeanor only if a defendant falsified the records to commit or conceal another crime, and the district attorney's office almost always charges it as a felony. In Trump's case, the district attorney, Alvin Bragg, has said the former president was trying to cover up the election conspiracy. It is now 19 minutes past the hour. Morning front pages for Monday, May 6, 2024, will return after the weather forecast. National forecast. Severe thunderstorms will develop from South Dakota to northern Texas later today, bringing the threat of damaging winds, tornadoes, and hail. There is a significant risk of widespread damaging wind gusts, tornadoes, and large hail from south-central Nebraska to north-central Oklahoma. Elsewhere, spotty showers could occur in the northeast, while showers and thunderstorms will spread across much of the southeast. Strong winds will begin from Montana to New Mexico as well as across the high plains. Gusty winds in Arizona, southern Colorado, and western Texas will lead to an elevated threat of wildfires. In the west, rain and high elevation snow will fall across the northern Rockies as well as the northwest.
For helpful tips on using assistive computer technology, listen Monday afternoons at 2 for the Keystrokes Computer Hour on Chris.
The forecast for tonight is mostly cloudy, with a low around 54. Tomorrow, Tuesday, will be partly sunny, with a high near 79. And tomorrow night, there's a slight chance of rain. It'll be partly cloudy, with a low around 53. Wednesday, there's a chance of rain. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a high near 71. And Wednesday night, there's a chance of rain, mostly cloudy, with a low around 51. Thursday, there's a chance of rain. It'll be mostly cloudy, with a high near 66. And Thursday night, rain is likely, mostly cloudy, with a low around 48. Have a good evening. Thank you for listening to Chris.
Let's now go to Lou for more stories on Morning Front Pages, Monday, May 6, 2024.
The next story is titled, Seeking Ideas, Toy Makers Turn to Unconventional Source. You, by Isaac Aronoff. Near the end of 2022, Lucas Bolt, an environmental artist and Lego enthusiast in Amsterdam, was working on a design for a Lego set the company had crowdsourced to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons, the tabletop role-playing game. I spent two very intense weeks working on it, every night, every weekend, all the time that I had, he said. Mr. Bolt was hoping to create the design for Lego Ideas, a program the toy maker started in 2008 to solicit ideas online directly from fans. Typically, designers post their concept on the platform, and if a design gets 10,000 votes, the company considers it for production. This case was different, though. It was the first time the company had given fans a concept to work with. Mr. Bolt had been designing his own sets for a few years, primarily for his followers on Instagram, but this was the first time something he had produced had gained real traction. A panel of judges selected his set and four others for a shortlist, and in a vote, fans chose his set as their favorite. Lego Ideas is part of a growing strategy among companies that are creating divisions devoted to going directly to consumers for ideas. Lego takes a much more personal approach, allowing fans to submit the designs, while other companies poll consumers about what they would like to see or speak to inventors about their latest projects. These initiatives are finding particular success within niche groups of collectors and other dedicated fans. There are about 300 professional inventors in the toy industry, and Spin Master is a direct contact with most of them. Typically, before an idea is formally submitted to Spin Master for consideration, a member of the company's inventor relations department has already had lengthy discussions about the viability of the product. For his work with Lego, Mr. Bolt will be rewarded with a 1% sales commission for each set and 10 copies of the set for himself. The final set, called Red Dragon's Tale, has 3,745 pieces and features a playable adventure and, of course, a Dungeon and Dragon. It sells for $360 at Lego stores, a price well above most of the company's mass market offerings. Lego gets thousands of submissions through the Ideas program, but the bar is set high for a set to make it to consumers. Normally, a set receives more than 10,000 votes from fans. The company considers it for production. Once made, the set is sold directly from Lego and by retailers like Target and Amazon. About 100 sets a year reach the vote threshold, though that number increases every year. And from those, only 56 sets, including Mr. Bolt's design, have reached production since the program began in 2008. Compare that with the 916 sets the company released just in 2023. The sets still go through Lego's internal design and testing, and the company meets with the designers working on Ideas sets twice a month to ensure the product is living up to their vision. It was very special to see, as a Lego builder, how they approach it, Mr. Bolt said of his experience with Lego testers. It was a whole team of designers, which was really cool that they spent so much time designing something that I came up with.
Manufacturing thriving in Farmington. Skilled workforce is helping sector expand in town and across the region. In a further sign of strength in Connecticut's manufacturing sector, EBM Pabst Inc. is adding more than a dozen workers and building a 14,500-square-foot expansion at its Farmington headquarters. The projected $3 million project will create improved logistics in the warehouse operation, along with new space for the company's tooling center, which crafts the high-tech equipment used in at its fan manufacturing plants in Connecticut and Tennessee. We're expanding our R&D set up here. We're investing in new capabilities, new equipment, and more people, North American CEO Mark Shearing said during a recent tour of the company's roughly 240,000-square-foot headquarters, manufacturing, and warehouse campus on Hyde Road. The company 2 years ago built a nearly 180,000-square-foot manufacturing plant in Tennessee, a move that Shearing said was necessary because the Farmington campus didn't have enough space. Sales, engineering, and the high-tech end of the company's manufacturing remain in Connecticut, he said. The region's skilled workforce in precision manufacturing plays a major role in keeping those parts of the businesses here, he said. Connecticut's long-term economic development plans focus on advanced manufacturing and medical sciences as two of the state's key growth areas. Just last month, RTX Corp. released plans to build a 313,000-square-foot building on its Pratt & Whitney campus in East Hartford. The aerospace giant will first tear down the decades-old OBB building. Their plans show it will be replaced with the multi-story office building. And last year, Mott Corp., a high-tech manufacturer in Farmington, announced plans to expand into a new 65,000-square-foot facility and hire 100 additional employees. Another prominent Farmington employer, Germany's Trump Inc., is adding about 56,000 square feet to its advanced manufacturing center in the industrial park. The company's campus in Farmington holds its U.S. headquarters and totals roughly 400,000 square feet of space used for manufacturing as well as offices and warehousing. We're currently adding over the last year, we hired over 100 people for the organization. It was in R&D, supply chain and sourcing, industrial engineering, and automation engineering, Shearing said.
China's EV innovations worry rivals elsewhere by Keith Bradshaw. Automakers in China are building a new generation of bigger, more technologically advanced and competitive electric cars, threatening to leap further ahead of their global rivals as they step up exports around the world. The dozens of car companies operating in China plan to put 71 new battery electric models on sale this year. Many new models have taller hoods for a bolder appearance and more storage space. The cars have bigger tires that improve braking. The seats are thicker and more comfortable. The batteries are even smaller, more powerful, and quicker to recharge. The changes are aimed at making the cars even more appealing for customers in China and more competitive abroad. Along with the plug-in hybrid cars, battery electric cars are taking sales away from gasoline-powered cars and their manufacturers. China is also moving ahead with the technology and regulations for self-driving cars. The authorities approved data security arrangements last week for more capable autonomous vehicles. They approved cars from Tesla, the American electric company that also builds and sells cars in China, as well as five Chinese manufacturers, including BYD, Tesla's principal global rival, and NIO, a longtime player in China's auto sector. The approval shows the Chinese government's eagerness to push the development of self-driving vehicles, which are widely seen as central to future competitiveness in the car industry. The technology is more compatible with battery electric cars than with plug-in hybrids or gasoline cars, and Chinese companies are trying to catch up with Tesla, the leader in these systems. Established companies in Europe also face formidable challenges. China's electric car exports to Europe are climbing, prompting a European Union investigation on whether they are unfairly subsidized. Ralph Bradshada, the chief executive of Volkswagen China, called for Chinese manufacturers to buy car parts in Europe and assemble them using European workers. Then they will have a handle on a European labor force, European enterprises, and they have to compete in the same environment as we are competing. China has used steep tariffs and other measures to require that multinationals make car in China and Chinese market. Our next story from the New York Times is an obituary, actually, star of minimalism and the master of reinvention, Frank Stella, 1936 to 2024, by William Grimes. Frank Stella, whose laconic pinstripe black paintings of the late 50s closed the door on abstract expressionism and pointed the way to an era of cool minimalism, died on Saturday at his home in the West Village of Manhattan. He was 87. His wife, Dr. Harriet McGurk, said the cause was lymphoma. Mr. Stella was a dominant figure in post-war American art, a restless, relentless innovator whose explorations of color and form made him an outside presence, endlessly discussed and constantly on exhibit. Few American artists of the 20th century arrived with quite his éclat. He was in his early 20s when his large-scale black paintings, precisely delineated black stripes separated by thin lines of blank canvas, took an art form by storm. Austere, self-reliant, opaque, they cast a chilling spell. Writing in Art International magazine in 1960, the art historian William Rubin declared himself almost mesmerized by the eerie, magical presence of the paintings. Time only ratified the consensus. They remain some of the most unforgettable, provocative paintings in the recent history of American modernism, the critic Karen Wilkin wrote in The New Criterion in 2007. In 1989, Tomlinson Court Park, a black painting from 1959, sold at auction for $5 million. Mr. Stella, a formalist of Calvinist severity, rejected all attempts to interpret his work. The sense of mystery, he added, was a matter of technical, spatial, and painterly ambiguities. In an oft-quoted admonition to critics, he insisted that what you see is what you see, a formulation that became the unofficial motto of the minimalist movement. A sculpture of Mr. Stella's called Jasper's Split Star from 2017, constructed out of six small geometrical grids that rest on an aluminum base, was installed in the public plaza in front of 7 World Trade Center in November 2021. The full range of his work was on display in the career-encompassing Frank Stella, a retrospect at the Whitney in 2015, an outside show for a towering if divisive figure as observed as Ahab in his quest to reframe abstraction. Even the clunkers, such as the ghastly pileup of cast aluminum painted with wavy tie-dyed patterns, exhibit prodigious, indeed Melvillian ambition, the critic Josco Fargo said in The Guardian. They are the works of an artist unwilling, unable to sit still.
New rules for THC-infused products moving forward. 3 years after the legislation of recreational marijuana in Connecticut, the state is moving to curb the proliferation of unregulated cannabis and hemp products now being sold in convenience stores, vape shops, and gas stations. The House voted 130-16 last week for House Bill 5150, a bipartisan measure intended to set clear rules for THC-infused beverages and other intoxicating products made from hemp and sold under a loophole in federal law. "We can't ban them, but we can regulate the hell out of them," said Representative Mike DiAgostino, Democrat of Hamden, co-chair of the General Law Committee. "We say, okay, those products need to be manufactured in accordance with our standards. They need to be labeled in accordance with our standards. They have to have disclosures in accordance with our standards." The bill now goes to the Senate. A federal farm bill passed in 2018 removed hemp and cannabis-derived products containing THC levels of 0.3% or less from the federal definition of marijuana. The result was a flood of hemp-derived CBD products onto the consumer market. While a THC level of 1% is generally necessary for an intoxicating effect, the products made out of state for sale in Connecticut undergo none of the rigorous testing and THC labeling required of cannabis sold in state-licensed dispensaries. "We need to make sure that the rules are being followed, that there's not a product out there that is unregulated, that is being sold to minors, that is being sold in convenience stores, that is outside of the strict structures that we created," he said. The bill would define any sale of a cannabis product outside Connecticut's regulatory structure as a violation of the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act, easing the ability of the Attorney General and Department of Consumer Protection to take such products off the market. "And we add provisions that allow towns to now go to court and seek to shutter the doors of these vape shops that are selling cannabis or other stores that are selling illegal cannabis, and the towns can get a piece of the revenue and fines that can be levied with respect to that enforcement, he said. If you're a town that's approved legal cannabis, the last thing you want is next door a vape shop that's selling a competing illegal product. Seltzer producers, retailers, and their customers opposed the original version of the bill, which would have limited the products to 0.5 milligrams of THC per serving. An amendment raised the limit to 1 milligram per serving, allowing sales in package stores and cannabis dispensaries. The House also unanimously passed House Bill 5003, a measure intended to improve nutrition for children by various means, including promoting participation in the federally funded Women, Infants, and Children program, better known as WIC. Connecticut's participation in the WIC program is really low compared to the rest of the nation. About 46%, said Representative Jamie Foster, Democrat from Ellington, a lead sponsor of the bill, with Representative Kathy Kennedy, Republican from Milford.
Revised form on college aid brings chaos, by Colby Edmonds and Bernard Mokum. By this time of year, college-bound high school seniors are usually celebrating their choices, researching dorms, and even thinking of their majors. This year, that's not necessarily the case. Because of the disastrous rollout of the new application for federal tuition aid, many still don't know how much tuition they would be paying and so have not decided on where they can afford to go. The Education Department's redesigned form for the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A, was supposed to make applying for tuition aid easier and more accessible. But faced with a bureaucratic mess caused by technical meltdowns and severe delays in processing information and receiving aid packages, students say the new system has been anything but clear or streamlined. The first signs of trouble began in December with the form's release and have cascaded since, creating uncertainties for students with graduation right around the corner. It's been a nightmare from point A to point B, said Rena Atkinson, a 17-year-old from Michigan, who ultimately committed to Michigan State University after months of waiting. FAFSA is a free, standardized application for federal aid for college tuition that millions rely on. Students fill out one form with details on their background and household income to request tuition information for the schools they list. Before the overhaul, applicants typically receive their financial aid packages within 72 hours of submission, but this year the Education Department has to reprocess more than 500,000 applications, and students have been waiting for 2-3 months and counting. Students typically must commit to a college by May 1st. Some colleges have extended their decision days until May 15th or early June because of the FAFSA problems. Even so, several students interviewed by New York Times said that they were making decisions without getting a full picture of tuition costs, a move financial aid experts discouraged. Others said they couldn't commit without knowing how much their chosen college would cost. The FAFSA blunder has made some reconsider their plans. Yoha Vargas, 18, from Reno, Nevada, wants to study political science and became an immigration lawyer. She got into her top choice, the University of Nevada, Reno, but wasn't able to apply for aid until May. Now she is considering not going to college immediately and taking a gap year. But I don't want to do that, she said. Universities are also feeling the stress of the FAFSA disaster, said Christopher Murr, Assistant Vice President for Financial and Scholarships at Texas State University. I know the U.S. Department of Education is doing their best at this point, Dr. Murr said, but it seems every couple of days there's a new wrinkle, a new challenge that we have to adapt to. Experts are worried things may get worse this summer when this debacle could collide with a summer melt, a period when students who took all the necessary steps to go to college, including putting down a deposit, decide not to enroll by fall semester. Because of that, Mr. DeBrom said June 30th was seen as a crucial milestone when the school year ends and high school students will no longer get access to counseling. Will we be able to connect students with the assistance they need to finish the process out, he's asked.
Electric vehicle legislation stalls. In a surprising move, House Speaker Matt Ritter said that the legislature will not vote this year on any legislation pushing for electric cars, a blow to environmentalists. The statement caught some legislators off guard because electric cars had been among the highest priorities facing the legislature late last year. At one point, lawmakers considered holding a special session in January before the regular session started so that they would have enough time to focus on an important issue. But legislators rejected calls by Governor Ned Lamont and other Democrats to enact the California emissions standards that would have banned the sale of gasoline-powered cars in Connecticut by 2035. Now legislators have also dropped watered-down plans to study the issue after Republicans questioned the potential political makeup of the special task force that had been expected. With the 2024 regular legislative session scheduled to end at midnight Wednesday, Ritter said he does not expect debate on the issue. "I don't think so," Ritter told reporters Friday at the state capitol. "I like the study commission. I see the value in it. I'm not sure that many people share my thoughts. Sometimes as a speaker, you lose. I like the commission, I think. It keeps it alive. I think our state was shocked at how much pushback there was and how maybe woefully unprepared we were. I don't see it getting better by doing nothing, but some people think the commission is not worth it, so you can't win them all." Regarding studying the issue, Ritter said people don't want to do it. "No, people don't want to do it. I'm a little disappointed." Depending on who wins in the crucial November elections and the size of any potential Democratic majorities at the state and federal levels, Ritter said the issue could be revisited in 2025. "Maybe. We'll see. I don't know," Ritter said. "Depends on who wins, especially down in D.C. One of the problems is that some Democratic legislators question the benefit and the impact in the cities where many low-income residents either do not have cars or cannot afford electric vehicles." Ritter had said previously that legislative concerns had been raised by critics about the affordability of the switch to electric cars, adding that he believes that the state should help subsidize the cost of expensive electric buses in struggling cities like Hartford and Bridgeport.
Striving to make forests more profitable than beef, in Brazil, new efforts to restore the Amazon and cut emissions, by Manuela Adroni. And this is from Maracun, Brazil. The residents of Maracun, an impoverished town on the edge of the Amazon rainforest, are mystified by the company that recently bought the biggest ranch in the region. How can it possibly make money by planting trees, which executives say they'll never cut down, on pasture lands where cattle have been grazing for decades? "We are killing pasture. That's a lot of farmers' needs," said Joseas Arugo, a former cowboy who now works in reforestation, as he stood on a patch of soil he was hoping to fertilize. "It's all strange." The new company, which is also Mr. Arugo's new employer, is a forest restoration program called ReGreen. Its aim, along with a handful of other companies, is to create a whole new industry that can make standing trees, which store planet-warming carbon, more lucrative than the world's biggest driver of deforestation, cattle ranching. It's the holy grail of the forest economy, and now it might be within reach. The stakes are high. About a fifth of the great rainforest is already gone, and scientists warn that rising global temperatures could push the entire ecosystem, a trove of biodiversity and a crucial regulator of the world's climate, to collapse in the coming decades unless deforestation is halted and an area the size of Germany is restored. ReGreen plans to restore native trees in deforested areas and sell credits that correspond to the carbon they lock away. Those trees will be protected, not logged. Their businesses will use those credits to offset their own greenhouse gases in emissions counting. The bet hinges on the process of a system that's being built from scratch and comes with a big challenge. Measuring the carbon held in trees and soil is complex, and many conservationists worry that carbon credits could easily be abused by companies that want to appear environmentally conscious while sticking with fossil fuels. Still, reforestation projects have created a buzz in the northern Amazon, where companies are rushing to buy up big plots of lands with restoration potential. "You know that people who handle cattle don't care much about this reforestation stuff," said Anderson Pina Faridas, a rancher whose farm is almost completely deforested. But he added, "If selling carbon is better than ranching, we can change businesses." In Mayo del Rio, reforestation workers have been planting 1,000 seedlings a day, working alongside tractors and making trenches on the soil. Drones are documenting their progress. 6 months after the first round of planting, the team is ready to measure the 44 trees in one sample plot. Luis Caridas Badidos Lombata, a botanist who specializes in tree consensus, walked across the plot to document three trees that had died. Many of them were taller than him, and one that was more than 2 inches thick. In a few years, Mr. Batista Lobeta said monkeys and armadillos would come to eat the fruits of different trees, and birds would feast on the acai berries, dispersing their seeds as they move around the forest. That's the cycle, he said. Watching the trees start to grow helped to dispel some of the skepticism that farmers across the region still have. Back in Macaroon, Dijama Soares, a rancher who works on land next to the Regreen project, said that though he still loves his cattle, he can't deny that the idea of bringing the forest back to life is beautiful. Mr. Soares says he never had the privilege of studying all the other things he could do with his farm beyond raising cattle. But still, he feels the unrelenting heat. He's seeing his neighbors work to address that, he said, is inspiring. We end up feeling like following the same path, he said, as he watched the sun set on a vast pasture. We see that it's the future.
It is now 45 minutes after the hour. Morning Front Pages for May 6, 2024 will return after these messages.
Hi, I'm Tricia Beatty, a Chris Radio volunteer. If you need a ride to the store, a doctor's appointment, your job, or just to visit a friend, call Nutmeg Senior Rides. Nutmeg Senior Rides offers 24-hour service every day of the year to seniors and adults with visual impairment in Bloomfield, East Granby, East Windsor, Enfield, Granby, Summers, South Windsor, Suffield, Windsor, and Windsor Locks. This alternative transportation program uses a combination of volunteer and paid drivers who provide rides in private vehicles. There is no restriction on the purpose of a ride, and help is offered to carry packages, fold walkers, and open doors. That's why many feel that using Nutmeg Senior Rides is like riding with a friend. For more information, log on to nutmegseniorrides.org or call Margaret at 860-758-7833. That's 860-758-7833.
Welcome back to Front Pages for Monday, May 6, 2024. And from the New York Times comes the story, "She'll Have an Orange Juice on the Rocks, Hold a Sippy Cup," by Allison Kruger. The first time Tom Maffei, head bartender of Lavabanu in Manhattan, saw a child order a mocktail, he didn't know what to think. "What?" There was this initial impulse. "Wait, is this okay?" he said. "I wouldn't explicitly target children as a demographic when I make any kind of drink." Yet he has noticed more children asking for non-alcoholic drinks. It's not exactly daily, but it's more than weekly. The restaurant, which sits inside Saks Fifth Avenue and has two free spirit-free concoctions on the menu. Most children get the Mr. Tasty, which comes with coconut, vanilla, Bergmeier, orange juice, and soda. "It makes sense," he added, considering that he created it with his own childhood in mind. "It reminds me of waiting for an ice cream truck." He ultimately decided that he still feels a little strange to serve the sophisticated beverages to children. It felt satisfying to contribute to family dining experiences in an interesting way. As non-alcoholic cocktails, wines, and beers have been samplings on bar menus across America, some children, people may be wary under the legal drinking age, have begun to partake. Typically, there is no reason they can't, though some contain very small traces of alcohol, or at least mimic the taste of alcohol. Many non-alcoholic beverages are made solely of juices and other kid-friendly ingredients. But parents and hospitality professionals alike are asking whether the trend is problematic anyway, financially, ethically, or for health reasons. In a recent Reddit conversation, some parents compared serving their children spirit-free drinks to giving them candy cigarettes. Not okay, according to some parent participants, while others said it was more like serving fake chicken to a vegan. Totally acceptable, others concluded. For Amy Winderstein, 43, a pediatric physical therapist in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, going out for drinks with her 8- and 9-year-old children have become a fun family outing. "Down here, there are a lot of breweries, so we all go out to one, and the kids will ask for a craft soda," adding that there are some local wineries that do flights of non-alcoholic wine, a white grape, sparkling red, and sparkling white. She added that one local restaurant serves mocktails with candy and toy fish in them. "The kids will sit with the adults and do their thing. They love it." She loves that her children can participate in adult activities. One of the other reservations is the price of these drinks, which can hover in the $20 range in New York City. The kids are like, we want a virgin mojito or a virgin pina colada, and the next thing you know, I'm paying $18 for each. What happened to the Shirley Temple for $3.50?
My whole life just shattered. Sister of Mantilden Fire files suit against New Haven, alleges building was illegal rooming house. 5 years after her twin brother died in a fire in a rooming house, Clarice Elrabi feels like half of me is now gone. Michael Randall Sr. died May 5, 2019 at 150 West Street in the Hill neighborhood of New Haven in what Elrabi's lawyer claims was an illegal rooming house. Randall and another man who died in the fire, Corey Reed, lived on the third floor where two apartments had been added. Lawsuits against the city of New Haven, which go to trial this month, contend that the house was only permitted to have 5 bedrooms, but that 2 bedrooms had allegedly been illegally added with only one way to get out of the third floor. I received a phone call that there was a fire in my brother's building, Elrabi said, and I'm thinking, oh, it's okay. I'm sure he got out. She tried calling, but there was no answer. My brother was saving people and trying to help the little ones with sheets and ropes to get them out of the building, she said. And one young lady, Kathy, he actually had to help her jump from the window. Unfortunately, the windows were too small, and he just could not get out the windows, and there was no other way for him to escape. Elrabi went to the hospital to try to find her brother, but no one would disclose the names of those who had been brought there. 3 firefighters were injured in the fire in addition to Randall's and Reed's deaths. Elrabi went back to the scene, and the fire marshal brought me over to the ambulance, and there was a body in there, and he just wanted me to identify the body. I went in. It was my brother, she said. My whole life just shattered right there. It was the worst day of my life, the worst day of my life, she said. They took my twin away. They took my other half away. I'll never be able to have dinner, lunch, or see his smile or conversate with him again. I'll never be able to have family outings with him again. According to the lawsuits, the city fire department had received a complaint on February 7, 2019 about the allegedly illegal apartments, and it had referred the complaints to the Livable City Initiative, also known as LCI, which enforces the city housing code. LCI then entered the building on February 11th and noted the alleged lack of smoke detectors and determined that the owner did not have a rooming license, the lawsuits state. Elrabi, 48, who lives in Windsor, said she was recently sitting on the New Haven Green because that was one of my brother's happy places. So I had some smiles and some grief and some sadness going on thinking about him. And as I was walking away, dead smack in front of me, the mayor is walking my way. I'm walking his way. And I had to stop him, introduce myself, and explain who I am to him and why I was down on the green and what happened to my brother 5 years ago. Elrabi said she knows Justin Ellicker wasn't mayor at the time of the fire and said he has a lot of things going on with the city and he's trying to take care of it and he hires people to take care of it and do their jobs. And in my brother's case, that job was not done correctly. Smith said Randall had knee surgery recently and couldn't get down the stairs and the fire broke out in the kitchen at the bottom of the stairs.